Today marks the last day of a major government program aimed at propping up the housing market. At the height of the financial crisis back in 2008, banks and investors shied away from lending money for home mortgages. So the Federal Reserve stepped in itself to provide money for home loans. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Over the past year and a half, the Fed has bought up $1.2 trillion worth of home mortgages. That's more money than was involved in the entire so-called TARP bank bailout. By making all that money available for home loans, the Fed has pushed down mortgage rates. That's been making it cheaper to buy or refinance a house, and it's been stimulating the economy.
An incredibly effective program impacting the mortgage rate, which is what they were trying to do.
Scott Simon oversees mortgage-backed securities at PIMCO, a major investment management firm.
Almost immediately, you had over a 1% drop in mortgage rates for the homeowner, and then ultimately more like a percent and a half.
Simon says that's a big reason you saw 30-year fixed-rate home loans down below 5%. So the question is now, when the Fed stops doing this, will rates jump way back up? Simon doesn't think so. The Fed has already been tapering off its buying, and the market has known this day was coming for many months. But others aren't so sure. Barry Habib runs Mortgage Success Source, which tracks rates and trends.
Hey, if I know that dinner's not coming tonight, doesn't mean I'm not going to be hungry. Well, I knew dinner wasn't going to be here, so I'm not going to be hungry. Of course you're going to be hungry. Of course when you stop buying $8 or $10 billion a week, it's going to have an impact.
Habib thinks the Fed pulling out will leave a vacuum in the market that could push rates up much more than other analysts think. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Now that the country's second largest school district is facing a very large deficit, it says it has to make a tough choice: cut school or cut jobs. Los Angeles Unified wants to try the former, cutting its school year by a week. That would save the district an estimated $140 million by furloughing teachers this year and next. Adolfo Guzman-Lopez of member station KPCC reports.
Los Angeles High School is LA Unified's oldest high school. In a classroom under painted laurel wreaths circling names of notable graduates, a dozen teachers met during lunch behind closed doors. Teacher Rebecca Solomon said it was a meeting devoted entirely to the proposal to cut the academic year.
I think everyone feels really strongly about the importance of saving jobs and reducing class size. And I think that's kind of the very first thing is to recognize that.
Another all-campus teacher meeting is planned in preparation for a binding vote next week by all teachers' union members. Students have been talking about the plan, too, eliciting whoops of approval from many, said L.A. High senior Andrew Kim.
I mean, from what I hear, everyone likes kind of the idea that, you know, they get 5 days off, 7 days off. And that's kind of like the cool way to think, I guess. But, I mean, I'm sure a lot of kids are also thinking, you know, these are days that teachers aren't being paid for and made to take off. And so a part of them, you know, likes the idea, a part of them doesn't like the idea.
Teachers wouldn't be paid for the furlough days. The shortened school year would mean graduation dates would have to move. L.A. High history teacher Felicia Perez.
It now has to be moved up a week, but that also means that our seniors have to move up their finals a week, which means that the preparation for their finals gets moved up a week or two.
So it's unlikely, she said, that she'll be able to fully teach about the last 50 years of U.S. history to her juniors and seniors. For nearly a year, the district superintendent, Ramon Cortinez, and the teachers' union have been locked in a war of words over how to close a budget deficit of $640 million for the next fiscal year. The union accused the district of protecting an overpaid bureaucracy. At board meetings, the superintendent argued that teachers' union leaders could save jobs by agreeing to unpaid days off. Opinions appear mixed among the 35,000-strong teachers' union. Ron Goches teaches history at a campus a few miles away from L.A. High and said he'd vote against the plan next week.
I can say with full certainty that we didn't take the fight to the district as much as we could have. And I have to attribute it to our union leadership, or lack thereof.
L.A. Unified's decision to slash the school year would be a first by any district in this economic crisis. Mike Griffith is a researcher with the nonpartisan Education Commission of the States. He says other districts are likely to do the same.
I think California's situation is a little more dire than their economic situation, and the budget cuts they've had to make is a little more dire than other states. But we can see states right now like Florida, Michigan, Rhode Island that are close behind California.
L.A. High teacher Rebecca Solomon wants to use this mandated week off to pressure district administrators and state leaders to stop balancing budgets on the backs of schools. Some of her colleagues, she said, talked about working on the unpaid days cut from the calendar.
We want to use this time, this week, to educate our community and our students to demonstrate that we're willing to take the cut, but we don't think we should have to. And we don't think the students should have to suffer.
So that may mean voluntary classes for students and workshops for area residents about economics and state budgets to explain the current economic mess. For NPR News, I'm Adolfo Guzman-Lopez in Los Angeles.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. At the UN today, international donors pledged more than $5 billion to help Haiti rebuild after January's earthquake. The quake killed more than 200,000 people and destroyed the country's infrastructure. Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money is at the donor conference, and he joins me now. Adam, $5 billion, was that more than Haiti was expecting?
It's a lot more than they expected. Haiti said that they were asking for two amounts, around $3.9 billion for the coming few years, and then a larger ask of more like $11.4 billion over the next decade or so. So today they were really only expecting that $3.8 billion. I don't want to make it sound like 3.8 is nothing, but that's what they were expecting, and they were actually a little nervous. Maybe they won't get it all. So when the number was $5.3 billion for this short-term immediate response money and almost $10 billion for the long-term, the Haitians were really thrilled and really surprised. It was a lot more than they expected.
You noted the challenges to make sure the money is spent well. I understand there's also a fundamental tension at the conference. Countries want to donate, but few have faith that the Haitian government is able to execute this reconstruction on their own. Does the fact that more money was raised than expected mean countries perhaps are more comfortable with Haiti's ability to govern and spend that money wisely?
They came up with a solution that seems to have been a rip-roaring success. I mean, you nailed it on the head. The issue here is that the Haitian government consistently scores as one of the most corrupt in the world, one of the least well-governed countries in the world. By the way, that's stuff that the president and prime minister have told me. So it's not like a fringe group is saying it. I mean, everyone in Haiti says it, and everyone in the international donor community says it. What they've come up with is a very complicated system of sort of three different international governing bodies. All the full details aren't in yet, but what's clear is, at least for this initial round of $5+ billion, an international commission co-chaired by former President Bill Clinton and current Haitian President René Préval will oversee that spending, along with Haitian government officials and a whole lot of experts from all over the world. So I guess that was enough to make donors around the world say, okay, we trust that our money will be wisely spent.
And did the money come with any conditions?
That's the big question. And again, the president's economic advisor, Gabriel Verret, was telling me, I still don't know the conditions. I've really got to sit down with these numbers and figure it out. There certainly are countries that said, we want our money spent on roads or on schools or helping women or helping young people, etc. That's all going to be figured out in the coming days.
That's Adam Davidson. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
Adam Davidson is with NPR's Planet Money, and he was at the International Donor Conference for the Rebuilding of Haiti.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today, President Obama announced plans to roll back a moratorium on oil exploration off the East Coast. He opened the door to more offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and the Arctic Ocean north of Alaska. The proposal represents an olive branch to Republicans. During the 2008 presidential race, "Drill, baby, drill" was a GOP campaign slogan. For Mr. Obama, it's a stepping stone to what he hopes will be a more comprehensive energy policy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Green energy has been the mantra of the Obama administration. The president champions solar power, wind energy, and efficiency at every turn. But windmills and solar panels by themselves are not enough, the president says. So, in a decision sure to turn some green energy advocates red, he's opening the door to expanded oil and gas drilling offshore.
Given our energy needs, in order to sustain economic growth and produce jobs and keep our businesses competitive, we are going to need to harness traditional sources of fuel, even as we ramp up production of new sources of renewable homegrown energy.
Mr. Obama says he didn't make this decision lightly. And it's still not open season for oil companies. Most of the West Coast will still be off limits, along with sensitive parts of the Alaskan coast, like Bristol Bay, a major fishery and tourist destination.
So the answer is not drilling everywhere all the time, but the answer is not also for us to ignore the fact that we are going to need vital energy sources to maintain our economic growth and our security.
Oil producers cheered the president's move. Energy analyst Phil Flynn of PFG Best Research in Chicago says it's a big step for energy security, especially coming from Mr. Obama, who downplayed the potential of offshore drilling on the campaign trail.
We've come a long way from the days when President Obama was talking about filling our tires with air, you know, could produce more energy savings than drilling in the ocean. I, for one, think it's a courageous move by the Obama administration because we know many of his supporters are vehemently against this.
Indeed, some environmental groups were quick to blast the expanded drilling. The League of Conservation Voters called it more of the failed policies of the past. Francis Beinecke, who heads the Natural Resources Defense Council, says it's a mistake to fall back on fossil fuels that generate greenhouse gases and to look for those fuels in sensitive natural habitats.
This announcement today causes concern about what we consider to be some of the most fragile marine environments in the country.
For President Obama, expanded offshore drilling is just one piece of a broader energy strategy. By embracing offshore drilling and nuclear power, he's hoping to win at least some Republican support for a comprehensive energy bill that would also curb greenhouse gases.
What I hope is the policies that we've laid out, from hybrid fleets to offshore drilling, from nuclear energy to wind energy, underscores the seriousness with which my administration takes this challenge.
Top Republicans grudgingly applauded the president's move. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell called it a step in the right direction, but a small step. McConnell also questioned whether the administration would really follow through and issue the permits for offshore drilling. But Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who met with the president earlier this month, says he came away impressed by Mr. Obama's openness to traditionally Republican thinking.
If you're a Republican and you believe we should drill, baby, drill, now's your chance. If you're a Republican, independent, or Democrat that believes in nuclear power, the store is open, now's your chance.
Graham has been working with Democratic Senator John Kerry and Independent Senator Joe Lieberman on a wide-ranging bill to address climate change and promote domestic energy sources. They hope to unveil their plan in about 3 weeks. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.